Today is Friday, April 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
It is a very different thing to engage in transactions that have a national security component to them.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking to foreign ministers of NATO as meetings wrapped up. Also ahead, we'll hear a first-hand account of the devastation left in Mozambique by Cyclone Idai. And Saudi Arabia arrests 8 people, including 2 U.S. Saudi citizens. It's all on today's International Edition. In the wake of Cyclone Idai's devastation, Mozambique now faces more than 1,000 cases of cholera. The soaring disease toll follows storm surge flooding that contaminated wells with sewage. International relief organizations are scrambling to prevent a deadly epidemic in the impoverished region, where the storm's death toll is already over 800, with thousands more displaced and many in desperate need of emergency food aid supplies. Joining me in the studio is VOA's Brian Padden, who has just returned from Mozambique. And thank you so much, Brian, for joining me.
My pleasure.
And welcome back. Well, Brian, what was it like there? What did you experience?
Well, the devastation was quite massive. But prior to the devastation, the poverty there is quite massive. So you're seeing this massive destruction of these very a very fragile ecosystem, if you will, that, you know, people living in very shanty-like towns with corrugated metal roofs, with the bare minimal of shelter and food to begin with, and now all that has been thrown out of balance because of this storm. So what we're seeing is kind of a scramble by relief organizations and humanitarian groups around the world to provide enough aid and support and repair to get Mozambique back to its level of poverty.
Now, some of the biggest worries right now, for number one, is the cholera outbreak. So how are they trying? How are they containing that?
Right. There's a few ways that they're working on it. First of all, they have to try to clear up the water sanitation system. The flooding had kind of overwhelmed any sort of sewage systems within the city of Beira and outside. And the city of Beira, particularly in the poor neighborhoods, they rely on these small little wells that serve different neighborhoods. And all of those had been overwhelmed by the flood and been contaminated. So the one relief agency that I was with, Samaritan's Purse, they're going around well by well and sanitizing these wells. And that's a very labor-intensive process. It requires them to pump out the water in the well, to clean the well with a very strong chlorine agent to disinfect it, and then come back the next day and pump out the chlorine again so that the well can refill through the filtered water in the ground with cleaner water. And you also have the World Health Organization, supported by the U.S. government as well, working through the Ministry of Health in Mozambique, giving now cholera vaccinations to massive people to try to prevent the spread of cholera. Ultimately, they've got to restore and give people clean water, because that is how this very deadly disease, it's a stomach virus that can move very quickly. If you get it, you could die within days from it.
Also, just looking at what are people saying, how long this is going to take for them to get back to, as you mentioned, the position they were in before it happened?
Well, the United Nations has requested over $800 million to help Mozambique recover for the next three-month period. Many of the roads and bridges in the region have just been washed out due to the storm. And so that you have a number of communities that are completely isolated and can only get food and supplies now through airlifts or by boat. Also, the road from Beira, which is it's a major port city in Mozambique, it is a feed route that feeds into most of that region in Africa. So it's for trading from and ships from the Indian Ocean. They converge in Beira, and then their shipments go in and out through Beira into the greater Africa. So, you know, having that city and that area cut off from the rest of Africa has ramifications beyond Mozambique.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. What an experience. That's VOA's Brian Padden in the studio with me. Well, Boeing admitted yesterday that a faulty sensor in its anti-stall system played a part in last month's deadly Ethiopian plane crash. Ethiopian investigators released their preliminary report into the disaster that killed 157 people, saying the anti-stall system kept pushing the nose of the plane downward shortly after takeoff as the pilots struggled to take control. Ethiopia's transport minister said the pilots flying the Boeing 737 MAX 8 performed all the procedures repeatedly provided by the manufacturer, but was not able to control the aircraft. The initial findings about the faulty sensor are almost identical to the suspected cause of the crash of an Indonesian 737 MAX 8 in October, killing 189 when the plane dropped into the Java Sea. Associated Press reporter Karen Chamas has more.
The faulty sensor triggered the anti-stall system known as MCAS, which automatically lowers the plane's nose under some circumstances to prevent an aerodynamic stall and ultimately cause the plane to crash. After several attempts by the Ethiopian Airlines pilots to regain altitude, MCAS once again kicked in, ultimately pushing the plane into a nosedive. The plane crashed and all 157 people on board were killed. The plane's impact left a crater 10 meters deep. Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg said in a video that the company is working on a software upgrade to fix the problem in its best-selling plane.
It's our responsibility to eliminate this risk. We own it, and we know how to do it.
I'm Karen Chamas.
Among the top stories in the world, Hong Kong took its first steps this week toward allowing extraditions to China, prompting warnings from across the political, legal, and economic sectors. UNICEF says an estimated 1.1 million Venezuelan children are going to need protection and access to basic services across Latin America and the Caribbean this year. And with measles reported in 15 U.S. states, public health experts warn that an anti-vaccine message is creating pockets of vulnerability to a potentially fatal disease. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. European Council President Donald Tusk wants Britain to have until next April to come up with a viable plan for its exit from the European Union. EU leaders would have to approve the extension, which gives Britain the option of leaving the group earlier if Parliament approves an exit deal. British Prime Minister Theresa May is set to write Tusk a letter today, formally requesting another extension until June 30th. Britain was originally due to leave the bloc by March 29th, but May got approval from the EU for a short extension to give her government more time to find a solution Parliament could support. The latest deadline set by the EU was April 12th, but no withdrawal plans have been approved by British lawmakers. The delays mean Britain is beginning preparations to vote for its representatives to the European Parliament on May 23rd. Well, Libya's internationally backed government is deploying forces in and around the capital, Tripoli, after renegade general Khalifa Haftar ordered his eastern military forces to advance on the city yesterday, sparking fears of a major showdown with rival militias. The UN Security Council has called for an emergency meeting today to discuss the escalation in Libya's years-long power struggle, as a number of foreign powers urged restraint. Earlier today, the AFP news agency reported that some troops of Haftar's self-styled Libyan National Army were pushed back from a security barrier by a militia in Zawiya, fewer than 30 kilometers from the capital. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told visiting NATO foreign ministers yesterday that the 29-country alliance must alter its approach to developing threats, singling out Russian aggression and China's strategic competition. Pompeo cautioned his NATO allies that there is a risk the U.S. will not be able to share information in the same way it could if there were not Chinese network supplier systems operating inside of their networks. VOA VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more from the State Department.
For 70 years now, NATO has primarily been focused on the military threat posed by first the Soviet Union and then Russia. But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo warned that new threats are emerging, singling out China. He said the U.S. can compete with fair business competition, with better products and better ideas. But he said that is not what is going on with China and its telecommunication giants. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
It is a very different thing to engage in transactions that have a national security component to them. When a nation shows up and offers you goods that are well below market, one ought to ask what else is at play, why it was that that entity showed up with a deal that is literally too good to be true.
Vice President Mike Pence agreed, saying the challenge of easy money from China is something European allies must contend with every day.
China's expanding influence will necessarily demand more of America's attention and resources. And as we meet that challenge, our European allies must do more to maintain the strength and deterrence of our transatlantic alliance with their resources.
Some analysts say China has not overtaken Russia as a threat to NATO yet because Russia poses a tangible military threat to several of NATO's smaller members. But Beijing is a real concern. James Kirchick of the Brookings Institution.
It's certainly trying to divide and conquer and sort of spread its influence on the European continent, but not in the same way that Russia has been. I should also add that, you know, Russia is meddling in European and American politics in terms of, you know, hacking and the spread of disinformation and sort of what they call hybrid warfare. And China hasn't really undertaken the same sort of strategies at the same level as the Russians have.
NATO foreign ministers vowed to work together to adapt to evolving threats in the decades to come. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Thank you, Cindy. The UN Children's Fund says climate change in Bangladesh is threatening the lives and futures of 19 million children, or one-third of all children under the age of 18 in the country. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report forecasts a grim future for millions of children who live in Bangladesh's flood and drought-prone lowlands in the country's north and in the storm-ravaged coastline along the Bay of Bengal. They are the areas most likely to be devastated by floods, cyclones, and other environmental disasters. Included among the 19.4 million vulnerable children are nearly 500,000 Rohingya refugee children. They and their parents fled to Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar area to escape violence and persecution in Myanmar. They are living in fragile bamboo and plastic shelters, which will not be able to withstand a climatic disaster. The report's author, Simon Ingram, says climate change will have direct implications on children's lives, especially the poor, who are most at risk from its devastating impacts. He says more than 6 million climate change refugees have migrated from rural to urban areas. He warns many of the children who end up in Dhaka and other large cities are forced to fend for themselves.
Many children being pushed into very hazardous forms of child labor. Many girls who end up being pushed into taking early marriages because their families can no longer look after them. And there are other girls who also end up in what is clearly a flourishing and expanding sex trade in the cities. Girls who are left with simply no other outcome available to them.
Despite the magnitude of the problems ahead, Ingram says the children he met during a visit to Bangladesh are not fatalistic. He tells VOA they're very resilient and determined to take their future into their hands. He says more and more youth activists are coming to the fore and becoming agents of change.
In the report, you can read about one particular network down in the south of the country where there is something like 1,500 activists who go out to communities, helping people understand risks that face them, helping them basically get ready for whatever might be around the corner in terms of a climatic shock.
Ingram says this sort of work is expanding and getting the recognition it deserves. The report is calling on the international community to support the government in implementing a range of initiatives aimed at shielding children from effects of climate change. It says children must be put at the center of any response. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, no solution appears to be in sight for 64 migrants rescued off the coast of Libya by a German vessel. Weather conditions are a concern, and the German organization is struggling to find a safe port where the migrants can disembark. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
Officials from the German humanitarian group CI said it responded to a call made to Alarm Phone, the telephone service migrants can call if they are in distress in the Mediterranean. CI said it rescued 64 migrants from an overcrowded dinghy Wednesday after Libyan authorities failed to respond to their calls. CI said everyone on board is safe, but conditions for the migrants are far from optimal, as many are sleeping on deck and a storm is expected. It is unclear how soon they will be able to disembark. CI spokeswoman Carlotta Weibel said a request for a safe port was made to four countries.
Tunisia and Libya did not respond at all. And Italy and Malta said they are not responsible and we are not allowed to enter their territorial waters.
Italy's Interior Minister Matteo Salvini said the vessel Alan Kurdi is flying a German flag and is run by a German non-governmental organization and with a German captain, and therefore it should head to Germany. The migrants on board, which include 10 women, 5 children and a newborn baby, were brought to safety off the coast of Zuwara, west of the Libyan capital of Tripoli. CI was in the area searching for another dinghy with some 50 people on board, which issued a distress call and then disappeared Monday. Weibel said a request has also been made to be allowed to enter a port just for shelter.
The ship is currently close to Lampedusa and it will also stay close to Lampedusa because it's the closest safe port and we have no permission to enter anywhere else, so it makes no sense to sail around wildly, so we will stay there until there's a solution found and we can enter somewhere.
Delays in disembarking migrants rescued at sea are becoming more common in the Mediterranean since Italy adopted a closed ports policy, refusing to allow humanitarian vessels to enter its territorial waters and ports. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Are you looking for a good time this weekend? Hitting the club, house party, or maybe just chilling at home?
It's called Future Baby, Future Maybe.
Well, whichever way you want to roll, I'll get you listening, dancing, and relaxing all in one gorgeous hour.
Good time. Stop wasting good time.
You'll meet artists on the rise like Dawit Sharonet from Addis and Swagger Boys Dynasty from Juba.
Tune in to Music Time in Africa with your host Heather Maxwell on Radio Voice of America.
There's also awesome current hits, traditional music, and classics. So get it all with me, Heather Maxwell, on Music Time in Africa. This Sunday, 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Enjoy your weekend.
Well, U.S. President Donald Trump is traveling to the U.S.-Mexico border today to view a border wall project one day after backing down on a threat to shut down the border unless Mexico takes action to stop illegal migrant and drug traffic in the U.S. Associated Press reporter Matt Small has more.
The two-mile-long border fence President Trump will visit is in Calexico, California. That's about 60 miles west of Yuma, Arizona, and was completed last October. It replaces another fence that dates back to 2009 during President Obama's first term. The new barrier also has a plaque bearing Trump's name, along with the names of top immigration and homeland security officials. Matt Small, Washington.
The UN Refugee Agency says landmines continue to pose a serious threat to millions of people in Ukraine nearly 5 years after war erupted between the government and Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Ukraine is one of the most landmine-contaminated countries in the world. The most acutely affected areas are in Donetsk and Luhansk, in the separatist-controlled region of eastern Ukraine. The United Nations reports mine contamination in eastern Ukraine affects more than 2 million people. Since the war began in April 2014, it has documented some 2,000 civilian casualties from mine explosions, including 400 deaths. UN refugee spokeswoman Shabia Mantou says the presence of the weapons limits freedom of movement and poses a serious threat to civilians crossing the line that separates the government and non-government controlled areas.
The presence of mines and unexploded ordnance means that it is hard or sometimes impossible to repair critical infrastructure damaged by shelling, such as water pumping stations that supply water to thousands of people in eastern Ukraine. Mine contamination also impacts people's subsistence farming and livelihoods, and it hinders their access to schools and healthcare facilities.
In the lead-up to the International Day for Mine Awareness, the UNHCR is seeking greater support for mine clearance operations in Ukraine and for more victim assistance. The gravity of the situation and horrifying impact of landmines on the Ukrainian people is spelled out in last year's annual Landmine Monitor report. The monitor ranks Ukraine third globally behind Afghanistan and Syria for overall casualties from landmines and explosive remnants of war. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, where can you find a 483-kilometer long lake, mountains of sand that migrate more than 1 meter every year, and some of the rarest plants on Earth? In North America's newest national park, of course, Erica Celeste introduces us to Indiana Dunes National Park in the central U.S. state of Indiana.
The Indiana Dunes National Park is America's newest national park, but the one that may have taken the longest to get that designation, says Superintendent Paul Labovitz.
The name change here was 103 years in the making. The Indiana Sand Dunes National Park was proposed in 1916 by the first director of the National Park Service, Stephen Mather.
Plans for the park were quashed during World War I when the lakefront property was needed for steel mills, and then again during the industrialization of the Port of Indiana. But nature in the dunes found a way to thrive. Then again in 2017 and 2018, Indiana lawmakers again presented the park legislation to Congress. During the historic shutdown of 2019, the park measure was passed.
The yeas are 300.
As part of the massive appropriations bill pushed through Congress to fund and reopen the government.
The fact that he was able to get it into the budget bill was a huge win for us, and it really, none of us knew that was going to happen, so it was one of the biggest pleasant surprises that we've had.
The designation from National Lakeshore to National Park doesn't come with any regulatory or funding changes, but it does give the dunes a similar status to the other big national parks, such as Yellowstone and Yosemite. Among the first to visit since the change, Bill and Betty Smith from Connecticut, who've already been to the nation's 60 other national parks.
What I want to see are probably the sand dunes. I think that's probably the standout feature of this new national park. I want to see some of the trail systems. I just want to sort of get a sense of the place.
The park has a varied landscape, a 483-kilometer-long lake, mountainous sand dunes that migrate more than a meter a year, and an intricate trail system with some of the most diverse and rare plants in North America.
There's always something special about a national park. It's beautiful. It's unique. They're, you know, precious in terms of natural resources, the natural beauty, the wildlife. And so it's just a part of exploring this great country.
The park attracts more than 3.6 million visitors every year. And with its new designation, that number is expected to grow. I'm Erica Celeste for VOA News in Indiana Dunes National Park.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.